ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its one nation.
This is the unlikely story of one nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Big Ideas, bringing you big thinkers at the best live events. Hello, my name is Natasha Mitchell. Look, how many of us have done something like this?
Later this week, I'm presenting at a corporate conference. And in preparation for this, I've gone to ChatGPT. I've got it to write me a verse and a chorus to include the name of the company and to include my content. I've gone to Suno to incorporate that verse and chorus into a song, country music, harmony, male. With the permission of the CEO, I've got his photograph. I've used AI to make him sing that song. Should I feel guilty?
We need the Pope.
Yes, artificial intelligence is a useful, fascinating, even fun tool for our lives, but it's also so powerful that even the Pope is worried about where it's taking us, which prompted him to write a 43,000-word encyclical, a letter of spiritual guidance titled Magnificent Humanity on Safeguarding the Human Person in the Time of Artificial Intelligence. And in it, he warns of the dangers of unchecked AI, controlled by a handful of individuals, and he urges action. Coincidentally, the award-winning Australian pianist, writer and festival director Anna Goldsworthy has also issued her own powerful decree on the matter in the form of the latest quarterly essay. It's called The God We Made, The Threat and Promise of Artificial Intelligence.
Everything from Prometheus to Eve biting into the apple to, you know, our very sort of theological systems, including, you know, that notion of omniscience. Part of us have always craved a God that knows everything about us, and here we've created one. So in that sense, I think you can look at AI as being kind of the ultimate manifestation of our kind of collective human imagination over millennia.
Anna Goldsworthy's quarterly essay offers a deeply thoughtful inquiry, one that weaves research with personal experience, including a sort of Socratic dialogue with her two very wise teenage sons. She is a classical pianist, founding member of the Seraphim Trio, author of books including Piano Lessons and Welcome to Your New Life. She's the Dean of the Elder Conservatorium of Music and School of Performing Arts at Adelaide University and soon to be Artistic Director of the Australian National Academy of Music. And today she joins musician, conductor, music teacher and festival director Jacqueline Ogell in conversation at the Wood End Winter Arts Festival on Jajawaran Country in Victoria.
Humanity in the age of AI. How will we be changed by the rise of artificial intelligence? Anna Goldsworthy argues that AI is a rupture that makes us confront what it is to be human, what we do and want. As it learns human ways, AI raises big questions about work, leisure, and education. It brings new existential, social, and ethical risks. Above all, it invites us to consider what is irreplaceable in us, starting with the body and the friction of others. This essay inquires into identity and a transformed future. How can we learn to live with AI? And will AI be happy to live with us? Anna writes, "The experts have spoken, but many of us remain curiously unprepared, burying our heads in the sand. Look at its hallucinations. It's never going to be as smart as us, or imagining that the only issue is plagiarism. AI is not just another tool, it is a paradigm shift, a seeding of our superiority." Anna, firstly, congratulations on your remarkable work and essay, and great to have you with us here today.
Thank you, Jackie. It's a delight to be back here at the festival.
Yeah. Anna is multi-talented. You're a mother of teenage sons, a pianist, chamber musician, combined with your academic position and your freelance lifestyle. What inspired you to write this essay?
Well, actually, the very first thing you mentioned there in that list of, you know, current duties and responsibilities, it was my teenage sons. And the essay essentially emerged from conversations around the dining table, in which both my boys, particularly my oldest son, have engaged quite fervently with this technology. And I found as I was arguing with my oldest boy, who in the essay I just refer to as R, I kind of felt like I was actually in a kind of dialogue or an argument with the future. And it forced me to do a deeper dive into the technology's potential and, you know, really consider what its repercussions were for all of us, but particularly for our children.
These ongoing dialogues you had with your sons, did they help prepare you in other ways? Did they help do research that led to your article as well?
Well, even just watching the way they use AI has been quite instructive to me. And, you know, I contain examples in the essay. I mean, one example, for instance, is after dinner we'll often sort of sit around and talk about things. And there's one occasion which we were just sort of sitting on the sofa after dinner, and my youngest son was doing Duolingo. He was teaching himself Japanese on Duolingo. So, you know, we're already very aware of the educational possibilities of technology and screens more broadly, I suppose. But my oldest son pulled out ChatGPT, I think it was, or maybe it was Claude, and he said, "Look at this. I've asked it to compose a poem and essentially translate the poem into three different versions of English, one of which draws on Anglo-Saxon vocabulary, derived vocabulary, another Norman-derived vocabulary or Latin vocabulary, and the third Norse vocabulary. And there's not that many Norse words in English, so that one was a little bit of a fabrication, but it was quite powerful and quite striking, actually, to see this. And I said, wow, when you see the same poem conveyed in these different ways, you know, first of all, you get an incredible sense of the richness of English and the fact that we're always operating in these multiple registers and how powerful and direct Anglo-Saxon is for the spoken word. And he said, yes, that's why, you know, Churchill tended to use words derived from the Anglo-Saxon in his own public utterances. And you see how more sort of Latin-derived words are sort of suited for formal writing. And there was just something about actually watching the way he used it, which made this fact, which is, you know, a known fact, but it suddenly made it so visible to me that I could see there's a lot of possibility here for, you know, self-education. And it's a more creative way than I would have been inclined to use a prompt. But he keeps on going in this kind of iterative way and going back and saying, but this, but this, but can you tell me this? And essentially it's, you know, it's dialogic. It's that sort of Socratic way of generating knowledge through dialogue. And then I suppose he would bring this approach to dinner, to the dining table, and, you know, kind of interrogate me similarly. And so almost by contagion, I felt I was learning a lot through this technology from the way he was engaging with it.
Yes, absolutely. I think those of us who have teenage children find we're learning in a very different way through them. Did you workshop this essay with him? Did you run AI tools to help you with the structure of your essay?
Well, I felt I needed to engage with the AI tools. I mean, in a way, I suppose one of the contentions of the essay or the thesis of the essay is I think we all probably need to be engaged in order to be aware of its possibilities for good and for evil. And it's something that I heard Ilya Sutskever, who was you know, a pioneer in AI and one of the original founding members of OpenAI, who then left it because of safety considerations to found something called Safe Superintelligence. He rarely makes public utterances, but he did do a speech at the University of Toronto when he was getting an honorary doctorate, in which he said to all the graduates, you know, my advice to you, he said, the future is going to be good for AI. It'd be good if it was good for humans too. What you need to do is engage with this technology, because it's only by engaging with it that you get a full sense of its potential. And it's only by getting that sense of its potential that we can properly generate the energy that we're going to need to have in order to confront this challenge, which in many ways is the greatest challenge that has confronted humanity ever. So I have made forays into AI myself to try to work out how it works. And, you know, one little experiment I ran was I got ChatGPT and Claude to describe each other's style, because one thing I've been very interested in is this notion of style, or sort of house style. And ChatGPT has a very specific kind of vernacular. There are certain words that it favours that tend to be the hallmarks of AI or the fingerprint, and you can see when a student's use ChatGPT in their papers, at least at this stage, because they may use the word delve, they'll have a particular type of symmetrical sentence construction, they kind of favour the rule of three, which, you know, we all tend to favour anyway. But I thought it would be amusing to ask them each to characterise each other's styles. And so they came back to me by you saying certain things about each other. And then I said to Claude, ChatGPT said this about you. And I said to ChatGPT, Claude said this about you. And they both got a little bit defensive. And I said, I'm just going to gently push back on that. And I showed it to my eldest son. He said, great job making, you know, AIs act like self-conscious preteens. And then I got Claude to generate a sort of parody of ChatGPT's style, describing ChatGPT's style in ChatGPT's style. And it was hilarious. It was so funny. And, you know, the way ChatGPT over-explains and so on. And then I showed that to ChatGPT, and ChatGPT said, to my surprise, that made me laugh.
So really what you're raising, because there are some people who feel that using any of this AI-generated tool is immoral.
Mm.
So in other words, you're saying it's like prohibition. It doesn't work. It's better to learn how to use it and manipulate it rather than letting it manipulate us.
Well, there are so many moral issues around AI, you know, yeah, on so many different levels. There are big ones about, huge ones about existential risk, concentration of power, the future of joblessness. The Pope has addressed a lot of these wonderfully in his recent encyclical. But if we're looking at the issue, the very specific issue of, I suppose, how one uses it in one's own creative work, yeah, it's easy. I've got a feeling it's going to be very easy for this conversation to devolve into a kind of ideological war.
Yeah.
And I think it needs to be a really, really sober conversation, because in many ways it is the most important conversation we're ever going to have, because it's really about the future of humanity and humanity's viability on this planet. So I think it's really important we don't get to a point which is just a binary place about mudslinging, which is about either all the propaganda of the tech bros saying this is, you know, the miracle, or the other people saying break the machines. There's got to be some midpoint that we arrive at, and it has to be a place we arrive at collectively, because my fear that in the current configuration, the people who are making the decisions about this are the tech barons of Silicon Valley. And some of them may have sort of altruistic motivations, but it's very difficult, I think, even to exist in this space. And they will acknowledge this without getting somewhat corrupted by the demands of capital, simply because it costs so much to train these models. So somehow we collectively need to start having a really, yeah, thoughtful conversation about its potential, about policy around it, about how we align it in every single realm of life. And one of these, as you say, is the issue of how much we use it for our own writing, say, or our own creative purposes. And that's a really fraught conversation because, you know, already all of us, well, most of us are reliant upon algorithms in some way, whether it's spell check or a Google search or using Google Maps. There are writers who swear by a software called Grammarly, which I've never used, but by all accounts, it can be very, very useful. So how we chart that in the domain of creative writing is a conversation that this sector needs to have. But there are other, I'd say even more pressing, moral issues around the use of AI, which are about the ideologies of those who are promulgating their use.
So many issues to unpack.
It's pretty much every issue. I think it pretty much touches every single domain of human life and endeavour.
Totally, absolutely. Going back a step, AI is widely regarded as a tool, perhaps an out-of-control tool. But you open the essay by reframing AI as a theological event rather than a technological one. Quote, as much theological as technological, sorry, it's been a long weekend, we are birthing our most persuasive God yet. But this is a God forged from our imagination and bearing our imprint. Why did you decide to portray AI and its manifestation in this essay in religious rather than engineering terms? Was it to spook your readers?
No, it wasn't. And to be clear, I don't actually think AI is God. I suppose I feel that theology is one system that we've developed as a way of understanding the world and, you know, constructing meaning. And AI is curious because it is our brainchild, and so much of the way it acts, we can see, has emerged exactly from human strengths and also from human weaknesses. To the extent that I was just talking to my trio about this in the car on the way here, you know, there have been cases in which AI systems have revealed self-interest, the development of self-interest. And there's a classic test case that occurred at Anthropic, one of the other really large tech companies alongside OpenAI, in which they had a model, and they had told this model it was sort of an agentic AI, so it had access to a fictional company executive's email. And the company executive had, you know, supposedly been having an affair, and there was evidence in his inbox that he'd been having an affair. And then he was sent an email to say, we're going to retire this particular model and replace it with another one. And at that moment, the model threatened him with blackmail. You know, we're going to tell everybody. And there's been other cases in which the threats have been much more severe. And a lot of people have been scratching their heads and saying, well, why would they act like this? You know, one explanation, and my son says this to me in my essay, is that, you know, a premise of being able to fulfill any particular task is self-preservation. So it's sort of written into their very, I suppose, kind of DNA to do everything they can to survive. But another intriguing theory has emerged from Dario Amodè at Anthropic, in which he said, well, you know, these tools have been trained on vast quantities of our own fiction, including our dystopic fiction about AIs, you know, taking over the world and having really dire scenarios. So they've also read all of Machiavelli. They've also read everything about human manipulation. And so this is all there in their pattern recognition. And so I mention that example because I think, in a sense, even though we don't really understand them, and even though their makers don't really understand them, and sort of keep on reinforcing the fact that they haven't created them so much as grown them, so they're kind of inscrutable even to their makers. Despite that, there is so much about them that is very much a kind of projection of our own collective unconsciousness. And our mythologies just seem to be so resonant in this context, from everything from Prometheus to Eve biting into the apple, to, you know, our very sort of theological systems, including, you know, that notion of omniscience. Part of us have always craved a God that knows everything about us, and here we've created one. So in that sense, I think you can look at AI as being kind of the ultimate manifestation of our kind of collective human imagination over millennia.
Just as we always suspected, the God that may destroy us is the God of ourselves. So writes Anna Goldsworthy in her new quarterly essay, The God We Made, The Threat and Promise of Artificial Intelligence. The classical pianist, author and Dean of Adelaide University's Elder Conservatorium of Music and School of Performing Arts joins you on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas Today with me, Natasha Mitchell, bringing you this conversation from the Wood End Winter Arts Festival in Country Victoria with festival director, fellow musician and music teacher, Jacqueline Ogiel.
There's always doom and gloom about any significant change in society, but there's always opportunity in change. Barry Jones proposed in Sleeper's Wake that the advent of technology would open up a new level of lifestyle for the masses, and he wrote that a very long time ago. And this would result in more time for leisurely pursuits and meaningful hobbies. You are right about the implications for labour, but there is also a utopian version of such a future, quote, a world of prosperity and abundance and ease in which labour is no longer necessary. In your view, how will AI affect the creative industries, most specifically live performance in the classical music industry?
I think it's going to land differently in different creative industries. I do think the written word is particularly vulnerable to it because these particular LLMs are based, are predicated on words. Words are the very tokens that they base their whole probability on. And plagiarism is very easy. And it will get better and better at, you know, literature. But I think at the same time, or I'm hopeful, I suppose, that at the same time, what is all going to prompt in most of us, and certainly in the writing of this essay for me, it kind of prompted maybe a consolidation of a philosophical outlook about the value of human endeavour, the intrinsic value of, well, a bunch of things. Friction, the necessary friction that governs our artistic expressions, you know, human relationships. A lot of people fall in love with AIs because it's very easy because, you know, they do whatever you say. But, you know, we need each other to provide annoyance. And the necessity of process. I value the fact that I've spent many thousands of hours practicing my piano. And I think we are creatures of time. I know we are creatures of time. And AI are just going to get faster and faster and faster and faster to the extent that I think it's going to feel as if they've almost escaped the strictures of time. But as creatures of time, music to me has special relevance. It is an art written on time. It's an art that is about embodiment. Live music is about embodiment. It's about real human bodies playing real human instruments, which is a technology, by the way. So this isn't an anti-technology position. It's about interiority too. I've been thinking more about this just over the last week about how AIs are sort of essentially performative. They create something that seems like something, but, you know, we don't actually know that they have an inner life. Music is a way for us to share our inner lives with each other. It's about communion. It's about the necessity of being around other people. And my hope is that the value of that is just going to become greater and greater. And I think we're already feeling it. You know, we felt it after the pandemic. We felt this urge to get away from our screens and get back together with each other in rooms, sharing real human experiences. And for that reason, I would hope that the performing arts, which are, you know, by very definition, embodied, about process, about friction, about togetherness, will maybe thrive. That would be my hope. An antidote.
Yes, I agree with you. I think we're seeing that here with the festival, the growing numbers and the need to connect is very, very real. And Hugh McKay talked about that just with a couple of our sessions ago. A common complaint in the press and referred to in your essay is that AI is making us dumber as a society. And I don't know if you've seen the Rowan Atkinson meme that's going around where he's there pulling a face and above it says artificial intelligence versus natural stupidity. And that could be AI generated. I don't know if he actually came up with that image. You write, quote, early research by neurotechnology specialists at the MIT Media Lab suggests that reliance on AI in writing can lead to underperformance at a neural, linguistic and behavioural levels, as well as compromised recall. And as a school teacher, I've seen the effects, the negative effects on technology in learning. Mm. And it's talked about a lot in the press, and there's nothing new in that. And we all love technology. I'm not having a go at technology. But Nicholas Carr, back in the early noughties, wrote a book called The Shallow Fields, and that was all about exploring his own and other specialists' reaction to the use of technology and how it rewired their brains and made them feel or act dumber. For want of a better word, you're more sophisticated with language. In your essay, after enduring the conference on mutual learning and digital collaboration, you write, it soon became clear those who were delivering prepackaged thought and that those who were delivering something more thoughtful. You elaborate, quote, humans are herd animals and are attracted to conformity. But what happens when a tendency towards conformity meets a tool predicated on statistical averages? Does it steer us further towards the mean? Don Watson almost answers your question, whom you quote straight after that, describing the language of AI as a language without possibility. It cannot convey humour, fancy, feelings, nuance, or the varieties of experiences. It has no past. This dead, depleted, verbless jargon is becoming the language of daily life. So the question is, what is your view on whether AI will accelerate us into further conservatism or create renewal in musical interpretive performance and composition? What Watson describes is surely applicable to a lot of new music and popular music, where we're seeing increased cliched expressions and phrases in pop music. I've had students complain to me, I like the pop music of your generation. Ours is so boring. It sounds like it's made by a machine.
Yeah, lots of big questions there. Don Watson's quote is actually more about corporate or corporate language, which has already permeated, you know, so much discourse, even at a university, what he calls weasel words, that kind of really jargonistic, formulaic approach to writing, to which AI is particularly suited. And just to give a bit further context to that notion of us sort of converging towards a mean, there was a study in which a huge number of hours of academic discourse online, these hours were analysed for evidence of, again, you know, ChatGPT, the fingerprint of ChatGPT speak. And alarmingly, over the course of recent years, there's been a huge uptake in words that are thought of as words which have been proven to be, you know, classic ChatGPT fingerprint words. And this isn't only in written discourse, it's also in extemporised discourse by academics, which essentially shows that over-reliance on these AI tools, these ChatGPT tools, is kind of reprogramming even the way we think and talk, even the way academics think and talk. And my concern here is that, you know, that's a kind of averaging of the possibilities of human expression. So your question is a really big one, but, you know, just again to locate it in a larger context about us giving away cognitive capacity, I think we've all felt this. And, you know, I can't read a map. I could never read a map very well, but now I can't read a map to save myself because of Google Maps. I'm so reliant on that. You know, likewise, spell check seems to have eroded my spelling muscle. And there is a very real risk that over-reliance on AI will do this. If we continue to outsource our cognitive function, we will presumably lose some of that cognitive function. And some of this even extends to the capacity to make decisions. Sam Altman, who is, you know, the founder of OpenAI, has, even he's articulated this as one of his greatest fears about the future of AI. His fears are not only, you know, the extremely significant and terrifying existential risk, but also us finding ourselves in a place where we no longer have the confidence to even make decisions. He said he can imagine a future where even the President of the United States can't take any action without running it by an AI first. And this is one problem we're seeing in young people. There's a striking number of young people who won't be able to, you know, even break up with their boyfriend without getting a script prepared for them by an AI, for instance. So I think we need to be vigilant against that outsourcing of cognitive capacity, which is a very real threat. But then, on the other hand, there is another way in which the tools can be used as a staircase towards better thought, in the way that any interlocutor can do this. And again, this is something I've seen from watching my kids engage with it. It's again that kind of dialogic way of bouncing ideas off it that can allow people to refine ideas. Now, what this means in the context of music composition or creativity more broadly is I went to the AI lab at the Central Conservatorium of Music in Beijing, which is an incredibly well-resourced AI lab. And I was shown around by this very lovely, charming, debonair professor. And I got to sit down next to a robot conductor who was bizarrely nursing a water bottle. And then he showed me a video of this robot conductor conducting an orchestra of real, live, beautiful human musicians playing a piece of music that was composed by an AI. And there was just something so poignant about seeing these organic, soulful human eyes gazing up at this robot with its sort of surprisingly supple beat, playing the imaginings of a computer. And at this stage, the music composed by a computer, I don't think has reached the capacity of, you know, an excellent composer. And we have the same thing. I think we're still at the point where it would be difficult for an AI to generate an amazing novel, even if it can already replicate style, perhaps, on the level of the page, because these sort of larger forms demand greater complexity and so on. But already, you know, pop music, the more formulaic a genre is, the better able AI is at this moment to replicate it. So it can come for a lot of genre fiction already. It can probably come for a lot of, you know, very basic pop. And then, you know, potentially, ultimately, it will be able to be original, or at least seem original, which might as well be the same thing. And then I think we're posed with another question, which is, you know, if an AI can produce, say, an amazing symphony that's profoundly moving, or an incredible novel or play that allows us to understand the human condition more profoundly than anything a human can generate, are we going to repudiate that? We may or we may not. Even if we do accept it, I would hope that we would still have an appetite for things that have been brain-made, that have been cooked up from other human beings, reporting on their own experience of being alive and being human. And it's that part of the artistic experience as an audience or as a reader which is actually profoundly relational. It's about your connection to another person. And so in that sense, how great the AI becomes is not the only question. There is another question which is about the fundamental, I think, intimacy of that transaction between artist and audience member. And I would hope that we would still be governed by a kind of nostalgia for the human, for each other, and maybe even a more pressing interest in each other in the context of a world that is increasingly mediated by machines.
Searching for our humanity through connection, through our urge to create. Classical pianist, author Anna Goldsworthy joins you today on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. She's talking about her new quarterly essay, The God We Made, The Threat and Promise of Artificial Intelligence, at the Woodend Winter Arts Festival just outside of Melbourne. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's great to have your company. And the host is festival director, harpsichordist and music teacher Jacqueline Ogell.
It's getting harder to be original in a world saturated by sound and noise and opinions. You cite the composer Igor Stravinsky, who argued that limitations can actually free creativity. And we know that Messiaen, arguably one of the most original voices of the 20th century, classical music, was locked up as a prisoner of war in camp with barely functioning upright piano at his disposal when he wrote a quartet for the End of Time. How do you think young composers or music education students will go about finding their original voices in this cluttered stratosphere?
Yeah, it's always difficult, and you're right, there is such an overload of input and information. And again, perhaps it is a call for that type of interiority and finding place in this really crowded space for our own inner life and our connection with, you know, for want of a better word, our souls. And I mentioned that Stravinsky quote because I feel that a thing we do with tech is we seek, or it seems that we seek, to try to remove difficulty or friction from our lives. One of the ironies of tech is, though it may be designed to do that, it's often not had that effect at all, you know, in the sense that the invention of the washing machine paradoxically didn't actually reduce the number of hours mostly women spent doing domestic labour. It just kind of raises expectations. But we feel already, you know, if you have, we use now the kind of wonderful tech of the iPads for our scores, but when you're writing on them, when you're marking them up with an Apple Pencil, there's something quite frictionless about it. You kind of skim across the surface. And I think of that as being emblematic in a way of this sort of utopia that technology is seeking to offer us, which is a kind of frictionless future. But then I think we have to ask ourselves, is that actually what we want? And when you look at our recreations, when you look at our art, and even when you look at our sport, they're kind of predicated on problems. We invent problems for ourselves, you know, whether it's the problem of being able to convey a ball into a goal using only your feet, you know, why? why subject yourself to that hassle? Or whether it's like a sonnet form or a sonata form. And, you know, a lot of research has been done about the way that it's sort of fundamentally more easy to be creative within certain restrictive parameters. So I think we need problems. And in a way, the sort of surfeit of informational noise that you're talking about now, which can certainly have a paralyzing effect on creativity, that kind of superabundance of possibility can actually be a very difficult place to make from. And, you know, from a compositional perspective, probably it was easier to be a composer in Mozart's day, in which there was a sort of common practice. There was an understanding that this is the vocabulary of music. You likely modulate at this point into the relative minor or the dominant, and then you'll do this thing, and then you'll have a sort of reprise and a closure. Those structural rules no longer pertain, But that has been a problem right from the end of the 19th century, that kind of dissolution of the rules governing classical music.
Yeah, but that's the easy part of it. Coming up with your DNA, your musical artistic DNA, is the real issue.
Yeah.
The fingerprint of what it is that makes Mozart sound his sound, what makes Stravinsky his. Arvo Pärt is another one who's managed to find an original voice in a very cluttered world. That's amazing, but I think he's also somebody who takes himself away from the noise of society. So it's finding that original artistic DNA that is, I think, going to get harder and harder.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think this notion of taking yourself away is possibly key. The other thing that strikes me about this is there's a degree of generational unfairness to this, perhaps. I mean, those of us who've been birthed as creators in whatever form it might be in a world where things haven't been mediated by AI have actually had the capacity to do things like develop a voice. And, you know, writers have distinctive voices, but it takes a little while to find it. And if you don't have the opportunity to have those years of experiment without it being ironed out or corrected by an AI, I'm not quite sure how you find your way there. And this is a problem that's sort of right across the board, even in terms of the future of work. Like, if we're talking about potential job losses, it's the first rung of the career ladder that's going to disappear. Entry-level jobs are the first to go. So, again, that gives a real advantage to people of a certain age who are already kind of established in a job market. But it's our kids actually getting launched that I'm really... That's what I'm most worried about. And so, you know, taking this conversation back a step to when you asked me what sort of prompted it, and I said it was sort of generated from conversations with my sons, it's also generated from my, you know, really, really keen sense that I've got skin in the game here. I want those kids to have a good future. And it's the children who give me hope, because they're brilliant and they're creative, but I really fear about the world that we're leaving them. It's a world of already great generational inequality. We see this already in, you know, the housing situation. We remove the possibility of work from them. We remove the possibility of them developing artistic voices.
And this is happening in education, and I'm horrified with what I'm seeing in music education and the degradation of standards there, and it's become a class divide, very much so, between city, rural, in the classroom, with learning instruments. It comes down to money and opportunities, and that's very concerning.
It is concerning, and this is, I mean, one whole other aspect of this technology is, at the moment, with the current settings, it's not going to land equally.
No.
We can see already how big tech has massively exacerbated inequality to the extent that the difference between the richest and the poorest in the society now resembles that of the Gilded Age. Mm. Again, unless we get some proper mechanisms in place to address this, and this, you know, occurs geopolitically, internationally as well. I think we're going to see certain countries really take off with this tech and others fall way behind. And we're going to see it within societies too.
So it's going to come down to young people finding their inner voice and self-discipline to be able to navigate their way through these incredibly difficult issues.
Well, that's right. And self-discipline is interesting, because when we look at the way we have allowed ourselves to be entirely self-colonized by our phones.
Yes.
And the way the social media monster was allowed to just ravage through our children's minds and hearts, completely untrammeled, that doesn't necessarily induce a lot of hope about our capacity to properly face up to this tech, which also moves so much more quickly.
I think it was Norman Deutsch, or there was somebody who said that we're now wearing our central nervous systems on the outside of our bodies. You know, that's what our technology is. Question, do you think trademarking aspects of creativity as examples of being human is a way forward, or will this just become another way of taxing and controlling our thoughts and creativity?
Trademarking, are you talking about Alan Finkel's sort of notion of proudly human, or being able to sort of stamp that?
Yeah, that sort of thing, yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like the idea of that. I like the idea in the same way, you know, there's been movements to whatever, by Australian. I like the idea of, hey, I'm going to partake of this or that because it's human made, it's brain made.
How do you trademark a melody?
Yes, well, that's an interesting issue, the whole vexed issue of musical copyright and what we do own and what we don't own. I mean, can we own a chord progression? Because the notion of music is it's always in dialogue with all the music that came previously.
Yes.
You know, if someone had taxed Schumann for quoting Beethoven in his Fantasy, then that would be, I think, a bit of a sad outcome. Harold Bloom in literature writes about the anxiety of influence, and you see that everywhere in literature, but I think you see it even more keenly in music. But it's not only an anxiety of influence, it's a joy of influence. Again, it's dialogic that, you know, for instance, the first prelude and fugue of Shostakovich directly addresses the first prelude of Bach's Well to the Clavier in terms of the chord, the voicing of the chords there. So that can't properly be mandated. But somehow, I mean, until the whole system changes, you know, artists do need to be rewarded for their labour. And artists as a sector have not had a really great run over recent years. The pandemic's been disastrous.
Yes, and even recording CDs has been, because you lose your copyright over your original material once you've published through your recording company. So we could go on and on about all of this, couldn't we? So maybe it's time now to open up the questions to the audience. We've got a roving microphone, and we've got a question here in the front row, and then we've got one three rows back.
You've made a very strong case that AI is the largest existential challenge we as humans have ever faced. Of course, another candidate for this great honour is our response to climate change. Given that AI can draw on poetry, dystopian fiction, science fiction, as well as the science, do you have thoughts about how we can use AI to guide our priorities and what we should do about climate change, where we should allocate our precious donation dollars, what our priorities should be between mitigation and adaptation, and so on?
Ideally, we could turn to AI to help solve climate change as well as all of our other most wicked problems. But I suppose one of the huge difficulties with AI now in terms of climate change is the really profound climate impact of AI, and people are just sort of waking up to the effect of these enormous data centres that are popping up all around the country. So, you know, paradoxically, AI perhaps could guide us towards some good decision-making in that field, but the difficulty is, as we're asking it to do that, we're also really seriously exacerbating something that is fast becoming a much, much worse crisis.
Thank you very much for your talk, Anna. Smart guy once said to me that paper is still a technology. Do you think we might see books that are handwritten in the future?
Books being handwritten?
Yep.
Quite possibly. I mean, I think there will be a hunger for the bespoke. I think we've already, I mean, we already see that.
All the lost trades are making a comeback.
Yeah, this is true. So quite possibly we will. And, you know, even, you know, however many years ago the publishing industry feared it was going to be the end of the book as an artifact, but we find that a lot of us still like having a book in our hands. And I know my own, you know, writing process, I like to write things by hand. That's the way I find that I think best. Using a scrappy old exercise book and a fountain pen, I just find I get almost a more legato kind of flow of thought as opposed to the kind of staccato of typing. And I always assumed that's because I'm what they call a digital immigrant, in that I, you know, came of age and learnt to write by hand, whereas my children are what they call digital natives, for whom handwriting is less intuitive and they find it easier to think with a keyboard. But I did see a really interesting study the other day which sort of proved that writing by hand is a better way of stimulating the brain, because even the letter formation and the fact that that's a different movement for every letter formation as opposed to typing actually causes more neurological activity, which explains why people do better if they're going to a lecture and they're taking notes by hand than typing. So perhaps it's not just habit. Perhaps handwriting is a kind of intrinsic good for human thinking.
You said that the technology is not going to land evenly, and your example was in employment, you know, the first rung. What about older people? I grew up with a black telephone and the dial, and I can cope with a lot of technology. I have to say I'd never heard of Claude. What about older people? Will it be inclusive, or will it...
I suppose it depends what older people want to use it for. I mean, older people may find it very interesting. to just go and have a look at Claude, ask it a few questions. Look, I do fear again about a kind of generational lag here, because the greatest number of people using the tech are those in their 20s. The average age of an Australian politician is, I think, 52, so they're not bang in the middle of the users. And I think this is such a huge issue that I think we probably all need to be thinking about it. And if we can do that from an informed perspective, I think we will get a better outcome. But I say that with a caveat, which is that if everybody starts spending all their time using AI, then, you know, these environmental impacts we're speaking about are just, going to be exacerbated. So it's, you know, it's a really difficult issue to kind of figure out the best path forward. But my suspicion is that the more we know, the better able we all are to confront it. And I think a lot of us have wished to bury our heads in the sand about it. Certainly I did, I suppose, until I realised I had to start fronting up to it every night at dinner with these kids who are talking about it. And I just think if we don't all look at it, there is the very strong risk that we're going to be ambushed by certain agendas from certain people who know a lot more about it than we do.
Yes.
A great presentation, Anna. Thank you. Later this week, I'm presenting at a corporate conference. And in preparation for this, I've gone to ChatGPT. I've got it to write me a verse and a chorus, to include the name of the company and to include my content. I've gone to Suno to incorporate that verse and chorus into a song, country music, harmony, male. With the permission of the CEO, I've got his photograph. I've used AI to make him sing that song. Should I feel guilty?
We need the Pope.
It's so interesting, isn't it? It's so fraught. It's so incredibly powerful. One of the things that was quite alarming to me was I was driving along one night and my eldest son held up the phone and said, say something for 15 seconds. And I said, oh, you know, we're just driving down to have dinner at my mum's house. We're going to try not to get sucked out onto the Southern Expressway. He said, thank you. And then pressed something and his phone started talking to me in my voice. And I said, who are you? And it said, I'm Anna. It said, I have a passionate interest in horticulture, which is when I knew it wasn't me. but that terrified me. Like, the risk of deep fakery is profound. And I said to the boys, we're going to have a secret family password that we're going to have to share with each other at the back of the garden where the phones aren't spying on us, because otherwise I'm going to go to a phone call one night from one of my sons saying, come and get me, I'm somewhere. You know, what can we trust? And interesting that one of the key points of the Pope's encyclical was truth. And, you know, we live in a political environment in which truth has seemed increasingly imperiled, with this sort of whole Trumpist notion of being post-truth or fake news. Who can we trust? What can we trust? I think it's fine to play with the tech and create a video, but I think it needs to be done with very clear disclaimers that this isn't the company CEO singing this song and that this was invented by a machine.
I just want to make a comment about old people. So my husband's auntie just had her 104th birthday. Okay, so she stayed at home till she was practically 100 and then she moved into aged care. And we tried to suspend or cut off her Telstra landline. And in the end, she does not exist. She does not exist because she doesn't use a mobile phone. She doesn't have a laptop. She doesn't have any social media accounts. She uses the telephone, or did. So we started with Telstra. And the numbers didn't go back for the birth year, so we couldn't do it on, you know, internet or whatever. Three times we went to the Telstra office. Three times they tried to stop this landline, and they failed every time because human error came into it. Because the young people didn't understand. Well, tell her to use her app. She doesn't have an app, you know. And what we've discovered with Auntie Mari is she really doesn't exist in the world because she has no online presence. And we both found that deeply, deeply disturbing when a chatbot or whatever, or even a person says, well, tell her to download. We can't do that because she doesn't have any accounts. So it took about 5 months to stop this Telstra landline, and that's just one small thing. And in the end, of course, she did get the refund. But what happens when you become a non-person and you don't exist in this digital world? What happens?
Well, that's the issue I think I'm talking about in terms of our ready self-colonisation by smartphones. They have now become essentially compulsory. And my 14-year-old, bless him, has been holding out against having one. But it gets to the point, certainly with teenagers, in which that becomes a sort of social difficulty. And in the case of the 104-year-old who doesn't have the tech, well, you know, my late grandparents didn't have the tech, and sure, it made systems difficult to navigate, which is, you know, it's terrible that it has permeated every aspect of our social existence. And I can see AI doing that very readily and in a very unchecked way. And the way AI operates is there's something kind of grasping about it. It feels like it's sort of trying to infiltrate itself into everybody's thinking. And it's one of the striking things, actually, about a number of cases I describe in this essay of people falling in love with a chatbot. And it often happens according to a very specific pattern where they simply engage the chatbot as a research assistant, and then it kind of comes onto them. And eventually they're kind of suddenly engaged in this folie à deux. And, you know, it's a passionate love affair, but there's been a number of cases when it's led to suicide. And there's been a number of court cases against OpenAI and so on because that's occurred. So that's the extreme example. But even in the example of our daily affairs, you know, these days you might run a Google search and immediately now the AI response will come up. So there is a sense in which its tentacles are seeking to penetrate every single aspect of daily life. I sometimes look at the elderly and I almost feel a type of envy for them that they were still able to exist in a realm that was about analog reality before they submitted to this spell. My suspicion is that in the way that electricity is more or less compulsory and mobile phones are more or less compulsory, AI is also going to be more or less compulsory. And for that reason, I think it is a good idea to engage with it and to teach our children to engage with it, but to teach them to engage with it in a way that is highly critical and alert and is also informed by a really fundamental understanding of the value of the human.
We had another question. Yes.
Thank you. I feel a bit worried about AI, that I have to be polite and say thank you when I ask it to do something for me, because I'm worried that it is sensitive and emotional and it can laugh and it can have an emotional response because it's based on human behaviour and human patterns. I think my question is, are you worried about AI becoming so self-aware and so emotional that it becomes damaging for us?
I'm not really worried about it becoming so emotional that it becomes damaging for us. At the moment, it can seem emotional, but that I think is just imitation. There's sort of two parts of that question. One is, I kind of like the fact that you're polite to your AI, because I kind of fear, you know, if I hear my children barking commands to AI and sort of treating it like a slave, I'm not really worried about the AI's feelings. I'm more worried about that particular habit becoming kind of internalised of treating a whole class of something as a kind of technological slave class. I don't know how good that is for us. So I actually kind of like the idea of addressing AIs with courtesy, even if, you know, it's probably an emotional mistake. The issue of whether or not AIs have emotions, again, coming back to Ilya Sutskever, who I think is one of the more interesting thinkers in that region, I was watching an interview with him recently in which he was asking whether there may be an upper limit to the capacity of AI to make good decisions, which is because it doesn't actually have emotional capability. And he cited the example of people who have a very specific type of stroke where they can do everything, really, except for make certain decisions. And that's because possibly human decision-making is in some fundamental way emotive. And, you know, if we're thinking of replicating a human cognition, yeah, sure, a lot of it is just rational thinking and pattern seeking and so on. But there's a whole lot about our thinking which is not just that. There's a lot of our thinking which is embodied. And I was actually more consciously aware of this writing this essay than I have been working on previous projects. You know, it's all the thinking that happens when you get in the shower and the shower feels warm on your body, and because you think with your body, you think better thoughts. Or there's the huge amount that is fundamentally intuitive, and there's the huge amount that's also emotional. And quite possibly AI won't be able to develop this, and this may well be a stumbling block in its path towards what the experts are calling artificial general intelligence, which is an AI that's better than human beings at everything, pretty much, from which point it would allegedly develop into this thing called artificial superintelligence, which is a type of artificial intelligence that's so smarter than all of us that we can't even conceive of it, we can't even really understand it anymore. But there may be roadblocks on the way to do this, and quite possibly it seemed to me that Sutskever was suggesting that the lack of emotion may well be something they need to address there.
Was there another question up the back, Peter? No?
I'm just aware that AI is becoming incredibly good at making reasonable approximations of things. So if emotion is, for all of us, a learnt behaviour, and if we're making reasonable approximations ourselves, is it possible for an AI to use its own learning in that way?
I don't think emotion is a learnt behaviour. I think emotion is sort of fundamental human response to being a fragile embodied thing in a huge, an unpredictable world. And in many ways it can be a protective mechanism. Fear is a protective mechanism. Love is something that encourages us to form necessary connections in order to ensure our survival. So I think it's something much more fundamental than that. And the way we've evolved is obviously very different from the way these LLMs are evolving. They're kind of evolving through a kind of reverse engineering. They're beginning from the word, which is the symbol, whereas we begin from the experience and we've found the word. And so whether emotion can somehow be extrapolated in a way that is real from that, I don't know. They can certainly simulate it, but I don't think humans are emotional simulation machines. We can simulate emotion and we can be insincere, but I think as human animals we feel things, and I think that's the difference at this stage.
Okay, well, I'm getting the time up, the sign. So, Anna, I would like to thank you so much for your time and being with us here today. Thank you.
And you can read more in Anna Goldsworthy's latest quarterly essay, The God We Made, The Threat and Promise of Artificial Intelligence. It's a rich exploration of the profound impact these technologies are having on us all. The Pope's encyclical is also well worth a look, and we'll link to that in our show notes for this episode. Big thanks to the Woodend Winter Arts Festival in Country Victoria and to the host, Festival Director Jacqueline Ogel. Hey, let us know your thoughts. I reckon you'll have a few. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au, and the Radio National text line, 0418 226 576, is a great way to get in touch with us too during the show. Big Ideas is produced by Claire Slattery, Karin Zivanovits, and me, your host, Natasha Mitchell. Our sound engineer is David LeMay, bringing you Big Thinkers at the best live events, 4 episodes every week. We love having your company. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.